All right, welcome to Indie Media On Air. Today on KPFK, we will be talking with Kevin Ryan, a former guest of the show, a chemist and co-editor of the Journal of 9/11 Studies. Kevin is co-author of a recent groundbreaking scientific paper published in the Open Chemical Physics Journal at Bentham Open, which is a mainstream peer-reviewed scientific journal. This paper is groundbreaking because it demonstrates quite clearly, with all the scientific clarity and precision you would expect from the scientific community, that the dust from the World Trade Centers contained an unreacted thermitic material incorporating nanotechnology that is highly explosive in nature. Translation, this looks like the fingerprint that people have been searching for, given the hypothesis that the buildings were brought down by explosives. Now, people might wonder why this is considered relevant today, over 7 years later. My response to that is that in a time of economic crisis, and precisely at the time the Obama administration is going to increase troop levels in Afghanistan, the alleged site for the organization of the 9/11 attacks, is precisely the time we need to take a moment and look back at the justification for this invasion. For me, any increase in funds and lives for these kind of imperial advancements is absolutely absurd, both from an ethical standpoint, but from the criminality of illegal invasions wherever they may occur. But it is even more absurd when we discover that the foundation for these imperial wars of aggression occur because of systemic lies, cover-ups, and avoidance of scientific data. Now, what this scientific paper suggests to any serious researcher is that high explosives were used to bring down both World Trade Center towers. To maintain the fallacy of the official explanation for collapse and the larger story of 19 hijackers in Afghanistan, in my opinion, is going to require a serious scientific response to this paper, devoid of the usual ad hominem attacks often associated with media personalities from the left and the right. In other words, the results of this paper are staggering and should be confronted with the seriousness in the context in which this original tragedy occurred. If there was any legitimacy left within the for-profit news organizations, this story would be front-page news. But we know from our experience that it often takes voices from the small stations committed to free speech and the search for truth, no matter where it may lead, to start the discussion off. So I'm very happy to have Kevin Ryan on the show today on KPFK and to discuss the results of this paper. A few words about the paper before we begin. The title is called Active Thermitic Material Discovered in Dust from the 9/11 World Trade Center Catastrophe. And the authors are quite extensive, and I'd like to list them. And I hope that the audience will bear with me as we go into some of the science behind this, because I think it's really important to lay down, you know, a very solid foundation for this discussion. And then we'll bring it back and try to really talk openly about the implications and where to go from here. But the authors are extensive. We have Niels Herit from the Department of Chemistry at the University of Copenhagen in Denmark, Jeffrey Farrer from the Department of Physics and Astronomy at Brigham Young University, Stephen Jones, founder and co-editor of the Journal of 9/11 Studies, now with SNJ Scientific, Frank Legge, chemist and former guest on this show with Logical Systems Consulting, Daniel Farnsworth, also with the Department of Physics and Astronomy at Brigham Young. We have Greg Roberts, Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, James Gourley with the International Center for 9/11 Studies, Bradley Larson with SNJ Scientific, and of course Kevin Ryan, our guest today, with the 9/11 Working Group of Bloomington. For those that would like to download this paper as we discuss it, please go to the following address. It's bentham.org, just like it sounds, bentham.org/open/tocpj/openaccess2.htm. That again is bentham.org/open/tocpj/openaccess2.htm. I know that's a long URL, but it'll be good for the archives for people who want to come back and get it. If you couldn't write that down, you can go to 911blogger.com. And it's the actual link to the paper is posted there today on the front page. And there's other sites that you can do a search for the title. And also, we'll be taking listener calls for shortly after the half-hour mark, so please be ready to call in at 818-985-5735, 818-985-5735. And we'll be right back with Kevin Ryan. Kevin Ryan is co-editor and co-founder of the Journal of 9/11 Studies, which is a peer-reviewed open access scientific journal dedicated to studying the issues surrounding the events of 9/11. Kevin is also a chemist and former employee of Underwriter Laboratories, the company that certified the steel in the World Trade Center towers. Kevin has written numerous articles and papers on 9/11, taking a very close look at both the FEMA and NIST reports over the years, and he is co-author of the recent scientific paper we are focusing on today, called Active Thermitic Material, Discovered in Dust from the 9/11 World Trade Center Catastrophe. Kevin, welcome to Indie Media on Air.
Hi, Chris. Good to talk with you.
Yeah, it's good to have you back again. So, in my intro, I touched on some of the conclusions of the paper, but why don't we just start off with the basic conclusions, and then we can work our way back and explain how you arrived at those conclusions.
Okay, the conclusions basically are that we've discovered these red-gray chips in World Trade Center dust, and we've examined quite a few of these samples of dust now from independent collectors in New York City, and the red portion particularly of these red-gray chips is unreacted thermitic material, and it's highly energetic. So that's the basic finding, is that we found this highly energetic material, essentially an explosive incendiary material, scattered throughout the World Trade Center dust. And there is a lot of work that goes into characterizing the red-gray chips and coming to those conclusions, which we can talk about if you like. But basically, having gone from a group of people disagreeing with official reports, and we've got another peer-reviewed paper that covers that in the open Civil Engineering Journal, to noticing environmental anomalies at Ground Zero, and we have another peer-reviewed paper at a Springer journal called The Environmentalist that covers those environmental anomalies, to now actually finding what the lead author of the paper calls the loaded gun. A professor, Harrit in Denmark, sees this as the loaded gun that actually was involved in bringing down the towers. It's really a great finding and a great discovery. We're very excited about it.
Okay. Now, there's so much to dive into, and I think just let's start with explain, and I know we've done this before, but let's explain why the publication in a mainstream journal like this is important. A lot of critics will say, well, you know, if any of this had any seriousness to it, it would actually be published, but you have.
Yeah, we've got three now in mainstream scientific journals. You can imagine why it would be important to publish in a mainstream journal. There's some sense of acceptance by the mainstream scientific community that way. So when we have peer-reviewed papers published, accepted and published in these journals, then we've shown that the ideas that we're espousing here, the questions we're asking, are accepted by the mainstream scientific community. And also, it's part of people's need to see this as being acceptable and essentially approved by authority. And so certainly it has been that this line of questioning is very much approved by the scientific community through these papers, and interest is growing quite a bit.
Well, and that really has been an uphill battle for years, even to get to this point. So I congratulate you and all your colleagues on this work. It must have been quite a bit of work to get to that point, I'm sure.
It really is, and I wasn't trained as a research scientist. I'm an industrial scientist, a chemistry laboratory manager, and have been for 20 years. But these colleagues of mine are very precise and exacting research scientists. Several PhD chemists, several PhD physicists on this paper, and that's what they do for a living. So they know what it takes, and I'm actually kind of surprised by some of the work that goes into it and how long it takes. This paper, for example, was originally submitted in August of last year, and it took until now to work out all of the details and answer all of the peer review questions to the reviewer's full approval. And it was really a grueling process. And the other papers were very similar. The environmentalist paper was took 5 months, I think, from submission to publication. So there's a lot of work that goes into it.
Right. You know, and I think we've talked about this before, but when you're dealing with these kind of issues that really challenge the foundation and the premise of what happened on 9/11, and given the politicized nature, especially of the Bush administration, to me it seems obvious that there would be a lot of political pressure put on people to kind of avoid this like a hot potato. It's nice to see that this has been published and put through the rigorous requirements that you would expect from one of these journals. That's something that a lot of people have talked about in the past, and the difficulties of breaking into sort of the mainstream, and it's really nice to see that. One of the things that I think that we should really address going forward is I expect that there will be a lot of people who will try to denounce this as, well, yeah, you might find these red gray chips, you might find them in a lot of other places. How do we know that the samples themselves are legitimate samples? Maybe we can start there with the samples, and how are they legitimate, and how are they documented as legitimate samples, and then we can get into some of the specifics of the research.
Okay, well, in this particular paper, we've covered findings from four separately collected World Trade Center dust samples, and each of those were collected by citizens in the New York City area, who lived in the vicinity of Ground Zero. And so one of the questions about legitimacy has to do with whether or not these samples could have been contaminated in some way by, for example, the cleanup operations at Ground Zero. And so the reason that we are certain that that's not the case is that some of these samples are collected within minutes or days of the actual collapse of the building. So the cleanup operation hadn't yet begun, and that answers that question. And as far as chain of custody, we have signed affidavits from these people saying that they collected the sample, when they did it, essentially how they did it, and their signature and a witness. So we're covering those kinds of questions pretty well. As an old environmental laboratory manager, I can tell you chain of custody is very important, and it does need to be able to stand up in a court of law. So these documents do appear to meet all those requirements. And we're collecting additional samples as well. Those, it turns out that there's a lot of people who save dust from the World Trade Center. And so as other independent scientists get word of these papers and they feel that they're interested in the subject enough to try and verify the findings, then we'll be able to send them samples, or they'll be able to find their own through independent sources. And that's where the final word will come in, as far as were these samples somehow contaminated or different. And we found these red gray chips in every sample, more than the four samples. I've received six myself, and I know some of the other investigators have received more than that.
Now, why do we think that the red gray chips came from the World Trade Center?
Well, they're scattered throughout the dust that was very deep throughout Manhattan on that day. So essentially it's just one of the collectors just scooped his hand through the dust that was covering the Brooklyn Bridge, which is very near the World Trade Center site. Just minutes after the buildings had collapsed, they were covered with this dust. And so the red-gray chips are within the dust itself. So that's why they're connected to the World Trade Center.
Okay. And now the red-gray chips themselves seem to have characteristics that look like some sort of industrial process, and you go into a lot of detail in the paper. And one of the facets or one of the characteristics of these chips, and what they appear to be is unreacted thermitic material that involves some type of super thermite. And what this means is that they're ultra fine grain, right? That would require an immense amount of work to create them, right? It's not something you would just find in lead paint, for example.
That's right, and we did tests to evaluate whether or not it was paint-like material and found that it was not. Paint material control samples reacted quite differently. But yes, the materials that form a thermitic composition, aluminum and iron oxide in particular, in these sorts of super thermites are mixed on the nanometer scale. They're intimately mixed, and the ingredients are found on the scale of 10 to 100 nanometers or less. And so that's what makes super thermites super, is the fact that they are on the nanometer scale. And that's partly because the rate of reaction between these ingredients is dependent on the surface area and the availability of the other reactants to mix together. So in nanometer scale thermites, the surface area to volume ratio is very high relative to like micron sized or typical macro thermite. And so the reaction proceeds very rapidly because there's a greater reaction front. And so the energy is released more quickly, and they become actually explosive materials.
And that's very different from normal thermite that you would either make or find or buy. And this is very unusual in that sense. I know you've written about this before, but this technology certainly did exist prior to 2001, and you've documented it. Not only did you document it, you found that a lot of people associated, I believe, with the 9/11 Commission or NIST, and you can correct me on this, were actually involved in some of the research on this kind of material.
That's right. And to answer your second question, there I had a paper called The Top 10 Connections Between NIST and Nanothermites, because I was very interested in why NIST would not consider these materials, which have been around since about the mid-90s. And it turns out that NIST actually had been testing these materials themselves back in 1999, as early as 1999, with some of the first people to develop them in national laboratories like Lawrence Livermore in Los Alamos. So some of the connections include people like the directors of NIST who were responsible for the investigation and how they were connected to companies that create nanothermites, or people like one guy's name is Michael Zachariah, who's just the world-renowned expert on the production of nanothermites. He happened to have written 10 papers with one of the people who was leading the investigation. And the reason all that's important is not to try and point the finger at NIST and say, hey, NIST, you actually committed these crimes. It's more of, how could they possibly not think of these materials as being, an option for creating these incendiary fires or softening or cutting the steel at the World Trade Center?
Every other option except the one that they're intimately familiar with scientifically.
Yeah, and I don't want to cast too many aspersions, but it does look like there's quite a few people. And I've written papers before that show that the FEMA report as well was created by people who have all this expertise in explosives, but yet explosives never come up as even an option in these in the reports on these buildings that really look to the layman as demolition events.
Yeah. Now, one of the striking parts of the paper, I think, is that when you actually see a comparison of the energy dispersive spectroscopy, or the results, and how do I say this in a way that people that I can explain it in a way that makes sense, not only to myself but to the listeners. The graphs between each sample are almost identical, so you get this sort of uniformity of a result across all these samples, right? So it's not as though there's no comparison between samples found blocks and blocks in one direction, blocks in another direction. There's this uniformity that was very striking.
Right, and so the XEDS technique was used to map out the elements, and there were several other techniques that were used. Scanning electron microscopy, for example, was used for several different techniques to look at the surface topography and take a look at the different atomic number of the different components of these red-gray chips. And so we started out with what's the elemental composition? And we found aluminum and iron and oxygen, and those are the ingredients of typical thermite. We also found silicon and carbon, which are the two primary components that would be added for one of these super thermite formulations. So we found the elemental composition first, and then we started to look at how these elements showed up in this structure in terms of relative location to each other, and found that the aluminum, the silicon, and the oxygen were all kind of collected together in these tiny plate-like materials. And the iron and oxygen were in crystalline-type tiny pieces. And again, we're talking about the nanometer scale, so they're intimately mixed at this nanometer scale.
Right, which is not an accident by nature.
Right. No, it's not something that just would kind of form from the falling debris. For example, like people might say, well, the aluminum cladding outside of the building, maybe that's part of it, or the iron from the steel. Well, the steel columns and the aluminum cladding falling from a great height aren't suddenly going to intimately mix on the nanometer scale in these red thermitic mixtures. So, you know, from there we started seeing what would happen if, for example, we soaked the material in an organic solvent. And this is one test which shows that we're not dealing with paint. So, for example, paint, and methyl ethyl ketone was the solvent we used, is typically used for dissolving paint, and that's exactly what happened when we put a control sample of paint in the MEK solvent. But when we put these red-gray chips in there, something quite different happened. The red side of the material swelled up, and afterwards, after we looked at it again with the XEDS, we found that the aluminum appeared to be to remain, and the some of the other materials, like the carbon that was in there, seemed to be washed away. So what we saw then was aluminum actually without the oxygen, and so it's elemental aluminum, which is what you would expect in a thermitic mixture.
And that's important because that's what you would see in a normal thermite.
That's right,
and
in a super thermite, you would see aluminum added in the elemental form, so that can react with the iron oxide and give off the energy. So we did that solvent test that distinguished between paint and also showed us how some of the elements were located in the structure and what condition they were in. And then we actually ignited these materials as well. We did a test to see whether they would ignite. And the first test that actually gave us that idea was a differential scanning calorimetry, which is a test that allows us to see the heat flows into and out of a material as the temperature is slowly raised. So you put the red-gray chip in this tiny pan and you raise the temperature very slowly over time, and you see what happens. Well, with the red-gray chips, something startling happens at about 430 degrees Celsius. There's this very sharp and large release of energy, and that does match up with the what you would find with a super thermite. We found other references of DSC plots and showed that they react very similarly. They give off this sharp exotherm, that shows that something is reacting at a high temperature. And when we look at the result, we've got this charred material in the pan and these tiny metallic spheres. And again, that points us back to the World Trade Center dust, where we've seen so many of these what turn out to be iron-rich spheres, and that's important because molten iron is one of the primary products of the thermite reaction.
Right, and this fact that they're spherical means that because of surface tension, they would form at very, very high temperatures in a liquid form and then solidify.
That's right. So in addition, these spheroids or metallic spheres have been tested in several ways. So those that formed from the red-gray chip ignition were tested for XEDS, elemental composition again. And they had the same kind of chemical fingerprint as these spheres that were found just loosely in the World Trade Center dust. More importantly, they have the same chemical fingerprint as spheres formed from known thermite reactions. So aluminum, iron, oxygen, and silicon kind of showing up in the same fingerprint. And if you look at the paper, it's really striking that you put the plots up next to each other from known thermitic materials and World Trade Center dust spheres and these spheres that form from the red-gray chips, and they just match up.
Yeah. And it's what is really striking is that the size of these things, I think, for people to get an idea, I mean, the largest piece was roughly about a millimeter or two, but you know a lot of these red-gray chips were very, very tiny, even smaller than that, and yet they were releasing this enormous amount of energy and this highly exothermic reaction, and that's in itself amazing.
Yeah, and so in the paper we also kind of compare the energy release by both by volume and by mass with known high explosives. So even considering that the gray side of these red-gray chips appears to be non-reactive, and we go ahead and include the mass from that material in our calculations, we still see the red-gray chips to be on par with the energy released from high explosives. So that really puts a nail in the coffin of this question. This is explosive energetic material. It has very sharp exotherms in the DSC. Additionally, it can be ignited outside the DSC, and we can see the iron-rich spheres form. But the energy was measured, and it shows that the energy released and from the DSC, the rate of release, all point towards these materials being highly active thermitic explosives.
I want to remind listeners that I'm speaking with Kevin Ryan. Kevin is a co-author on this recently published paper in a mainstream peer-reviewed journal called Open Chemical Physics Journal at Bentham Open. And we are discussing the results, groundbreaking results, of what appears to be the fingerprint for high explosives that were used in the World Trade Center. A hypothesis that has been put forth by a number of scientists, architects, engineers, that the buildings were actually brought down by explosives. We are talking a lot about the science of it, and we will plan on taking listener calls shortly. The URL, if you want to get this paper, and for a lot of people out there, if you are a scientist, there's a lot of universities in this area, everything from Caltech, UCLA, USC, a lot of community colleges. You know, if you are listening to this, read this paper. If you're interested in this, no matter who you are, get this paper and read it. Spend some time, talk with people, and, you know, really ask yourself, where would you take this kind of information if you realize that, wait a minute, there looks like there was these buildings brought down by high explosives, and you begin to follow the trail, and there's a lot of questions that open up after that, and I encourage everybody to do so. The URL, and it's long, but I want to put it out there because it will be available in the archive as well. It's bentham.org, bentham.org/open/tocpj/openaccess2.htm. There will be a link on there. I believe it's for Volume 2. Is that correct, Kevin?
Yes, it's Volume 2, 2009.
And This is KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles and 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara and online at kpfk.org. So all this, with all this technical jargon, do you think that a movement based in Afghanistan with 19 hijackers would be able to produce this kind of thermitic material? Where is this kind of stuff produced?
Right, absolutely not. And I think my friend Richard Gage has made that point before, that this, he says this material, kind of material, is not made in a cave in Afghanistan. But what's important is that the some of the components could potentially be made in your garage. For example, if you had the rest of them, if you had a way to make nano aluminum, for example, and that's very difficult to make. And the first high volume production of nano aluminum that I'm aware of was in the late 90s, and that was by the Naval Surface Warfare Center in Indian Head, Maryland. And so you really need some of these components to be produced by high-tech facilities. So your question is appropriate, I think. Could folks in a cave or wherever they might be have the ability to make these materials? More importantly, on the scale of the mass of these materials, we saw that they were as much as 0.1% of the overall dust, which would mean that, you know, there's literally tons of these kinds of materials in the World Trade Center dust, and who could make that volume of these kinds of materials? I don't think a few hijackers could really do that.
Now, I'm sure when you put together this paper, you probably did your best to foresee the kind of response you might get from it. What kind of steps, both procedurally and methodologically, have you taken to answer potential critics?
Well, one of the things people want to know is they want a full picture of what would have happened with these materials or with a combination of these materials and other technologies. And so a few people have been working on those kinds of things. For example, Jim Hoffman has a site called 9/11 Research, a website. If you just Google 9/11 Research, you'll find his site come up, or you can go to 911research.wtc7.net. And so he has actually posted, along with this paper, a hypothetical blasting scenario that uses these kinds of materials to, in a hypothetical way, to apply to the World Trade Center events. So that's one thing that we often get questioned about. You've asked a couple of the other questions about chain of custody, for example, yeah, and contamination of the samples as a possibility. So, yeah, we try to focus on the empirical evidence,
right,
and first of all, get that secured and established, and then together, hopefully, we can all kind of figure out what happened and answer questions as we go along. We're not saying that we have all the answers today, certainly. So if people have questions, they should certainly ask them, and we'll try to figure this out.
I want to invite listeners to call in if you have any questions for Kevin Ryan. The number to call into the studio is 818-985-5735. That's 818-985-5735. What kind of response have you gotten, and where would people direct their inquiries?
Well, the two corresponding authors for the paper are Niels Herrit in Denmark. He's a professor of chemistry, and his email is listed on the front of the paper. And the second corresponding author is Stephen Jones, and his email is also listed on the front of this paper. So those would be the two people to ask first. And I've got a great deal of respect for both those people and for my other co-authors who each of us have our own set of knowledge about these kinds of things and sciences in general. So there's chemists and physicists, and I believe there's a geologist, a guy with a master's degree in geology on the paper. So if you have questions about those specific areas, Stephen Jones is a physicist, Niels Herrit is a chemist, We can try to answer them. We haven't thought of every possible question. We tend to get lots of questions with every paper as they're published and work through those as people ask them.
Right. In the process of, finding out more information, as it should be.
Right.
Let's go to Mary in Laguna Beach. Do you have a question for Kevin Ryan, our guest today on Indie Media On Air?
Yeah.
And welcome.
Question. Hi. The question I have is, how could all of this stuff been planted in this, how could this have occurred, given that it was there would have had to have been very complicated procedure to get all this set up?
That's a very good question.
Yeah, it's a good question, Mary. And one possibility, as I mentioned before, is found a fairly recent hypothesis by Jim Hoffman. And, he spelled it out in detail what this one hypothesis is, and I'll let you read about that. But there are several things to notice about what happened at the World Trade Center in the years preceding. For one of the three buildings, World Trade Center 7, we should note that it was occupied by some of the most secretive intelligence agencies in our country. So, what those people have access to do, how they can do things, is not something I necessarily can speak to. But for the towers, we noticed that the floors where the planes impacted and where the fires grew and seemed to persist for longer than they should have, given the fire load, those floors were all upgraded for fireproofing in the 2 years prior to 9/11. So it's really startling. The floors match up exactly out of this 110-story building, particularly in the North Tower. They match up exactly where the plane was hit and where the fires occurred. Those were the exact floors in the 2 years prior that had been upgraded for fireproofing. Again, Richard Gage, the architect from Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, has mentioned that in the 9 months prior to 9/11, the elevators were all upgraded for various reasons. And so if you ask about access and how these things could potentially be planted when floors are shut down for these kinds of operations, if the right people have access to those unavailable floors, otherwise unavailable floors, then you can imagine that these kinds of materials could be added at that time.
I see. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mary, for your call. Let's move on to Charles in Santa Monica. Welcome to the show. Do you have a question for our guest?
Yes. I was invited by a member of the Southern California Federation of Scientists because they were light on a panel that they wanted to do opposing the idea that 9/11 was any kind of an inside job. And so basically, I guess I'd like to know from your guest, can you compile some maybe with Jones's thing on the spheres, the micro, spheres of metal that he analyzed, and any other evidence you can put together as a presentation, because there's still a lot of skepticism out there about this.
Are you, just to clarify, are you saying that you were invited to do a presentation yourself?
Well, I was invited to participate in a discussion group they had themselves. And
I see.
There's only one scientist who's a member of the group who basically, I don't know whether he wants me to use his name on the air, but he's highly credentialed, a mechanical engineer, and he's of the opinion that, there's evidence to say that 9/11 was an inside job. And I was good friends with a number of the members of the group, so I was asked to participate because there's about four or five against one. So, I didn't feel, I'm not familiar with all the, I don't follow it that close. I'm not familiar with all the evidence that's been compiled recently, and I was hoping that maybe your guest could speak to that.
That's a great question, and I think a lot of people might be interested.
Put it together in one place, saying that, evidence from the spheres suggests this, evidence from you know, all the different ways of attacking the subject to say that, okay, this leads us to this opinion, and unless you have an alternative explanation for these facts, yada yada.
Yeah. Kevin?
Okay. Yeah, that's a great question, Charles, and I agree that there should be an improved presentation as we go along. There are several places you can go now. One place is Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, their website, ae911truth.org. And the other is a journal that I'm a co-editor of with Stephen Jones, the Journal of 9/11 Studies. That's at journalof911studies.com. And so there's a great deal. At the journal, there's over 100 peer-reviewed papers. A lot of them speak to the World Trade Center events, but I think we should keep in mind that what happened at the World Trade Center is just a part of the large number of unanswered questions about what happened on 9/11. But as far as the World Trade Center goes, even apart from these environmental anomalies and from the active thermitic material now found in the dust and from the clear falsity of the official reports, apart from all those things, we have a lot of eyewitness testimony, for example, and you can read papers by Professor Graham McQueen at the Journal of 9/11 Studies.
One of the members of the group is somebody who has done structural analysis of crashes, and he automatically discounts all eyewitness testimony, says it's very unreliable.
Okay, well, in that case, he's not a lawyer, for example. A lawyer would consider that generally good evidence, but there's a lot of photographic evidence as well. The characteristics of a demolition appear to be present with all three buildings. The sudden onset of the collapse, the straight down through the path of most resistance, which is probably one of the most critical points, and violating the law of conservation of momentum. There's no actual deceleration as these buildings come down, which one would expect if there was actually this crushing effect going on. So,
mm-hmm. You don't need to convince me. I'm just wondering what I was hoping for is a short paper that would present all these points succinctly that could reference the longer papers for supporting evidence and make it, you know. Such that a strong case could be made in a short amount of time for people who are highly learned and still skeptical.
Yeah, I would recommend the first of our peer-reviewed mainstream journal papers. It's called 14 Points of Agreement with Official Government Reports on the Destruction of the World Trade Center. So if you Google 14 Points of Agreement with Stephen Jones, it'll come right up. And that's in a mainstream civil engineering journal. And it just, instead of proposing a full hypothesis, it just kind of speaks about what the NIST and FEMA folks found and how there are so many unanswered questions. And it kind of suggests further research. And that paper, of course, led into these other papers, the environmental paper and now this examination of the World Trade Center dust. So hopefully that paper, though, is for the World Trade Center is enough of an overall viewpoint.
Well, Charles, I hope that's enough. I'd like to move on to a number of other callers, and I want to thank you very much for your call. That, again, was journalof911studies.com. That was one URL that Kevin had mentioned. And, of course, the papers that the other papers you mentioned and the paper we're discussing today, active thermitic material. I think you can probably Google that as well. Is that right, Kevin?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep, you certainly can.
Okay, let's move on to Laura in Los Angeles. Welcome to the show. Quick question for Kevin.
Yes, I'm interested in if you have any contacts with Tom Daschle. I think he would be a great person to get this kind of information to, since he has firsthand skepticism about the anthrax attacks.
Yeah, I think he would, it would seem, Laura. He was actually mailed some of those anthrax letters, wasn't he?
Yes.
Yeah, and those letters, that problem has never been solved. I believe the anthrax was traced back to a national laboratory, Fort Detrick. And so that's an interesting story. I don't know a lot about that. But Tom Daschle, other than that, I think was a key character in the early days of investigating 9/11 when he was told, is reported that he was told by Vice President Cheney to not look into this further. This was before an official investigation ever occurred. And I've seen videotape of him actually saying that, you know, it would distract from the very important war on terror. And to paraphrase, to essentially to look into why we've got this war on terror, which is a strange circular argument, in my opinion. So he was told again by President Bush, and at the time he was the Senate leader, and he was told that we don't want to investigate 9/11. We need to move forward and go and get the enemy. So, Laura, I do think that's important, and I will look for Senator Daschle's contact. I'm not sure he's very easy to get a hold of, but I'll try.
Thank you.
Thank you for your call, Laura. Let's move on to Eric in St. Louis, Missouri, listening, I assume, online. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I wanted to express my appreciation for the courage by Mr. Ryan and all the others who are investigating. I imagine they're going up against a great deal of opposition. And the previous caller mentioned Tom Daschle. I think there's a naivete with regards to our political leaders and thinking that they're going to actually do something. I can't imagine that there's been anything more explicit than the involvement of homegrown individuals in that event on 9/11. It looks very much, in a lot of ways, like the Kennedy situation, where there's the quick obliteration of evidence, but there's also the expression of the desire for this event and the Project for a New American Century, and we don't see any of that in the mainstream press. And again, I just want to express my appreciation for your courage, Mr. Ryan. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, thanks for your call, Eric. Really appreciate that, calling from Missouri. Let's move on to Lucia in Gardena. Welcome to KPFK. Welcome to Indie Media On Air. Do you have a question for our guest?
Yes. Another caller called earlier asking when did they put all the explosive in, and I was in at the World Trade Center back in 89 when Gorbachev was around, and actually I think something happened. They remodeled the building on the outside. If you see the postcards, I have a postcard from that time I was there, and you can see the glass, the faces of the building are all glass. And afterwards, I don't know when they remodeled the building and put these things on the sides. So it's not from the original building. And I believe that's probably when they bothered to install all those explosives. So we're looking at like 6 or 7 years in the making, you know.
Well,
that's my only comment.
Okay, well, thanks for your comment. Kevin, do you have a response for that?
Well, I don't know about that particular event, but I do agree with the caller that the operation that that was likely to have occurred, the demolition event, was planned over a period of years and was implemented over a couple of years as well. That does appear to be the case, although we're just speculating really on all of that, so we don't want to carry that too far. We want to start with what we know and move from there.
Yeah, and that's something I think it's really important for us to do, is to start with the scientific facts, the data, and then we can build our hypothesis about what happened later. But it's the evidence that's going to move this into a mainstream consciousness. Don Carlo in Simi Valley, welcome to KPFK.
Hi, thank you for your time, and I just have a question. Maybe your guest could get a little bit into what happened to Building 7. No plane hit it, and it imploded on itself, just like the World Trade Center towers did. And also what he thinks about all the events that took place on 9/11 and how that ties into the elite trying to bring about a new world government as a fact, not a theory. Thank you.
Well, thanks for your question, comment. For yourself and for the audience, last time Kevin was on the show, we did a whole show on WTC7. And that's a huge, big question. I don't think we're going to be able to answer all of that. But Kevin, do you have any comments?
Yeah, for those who don't know, World Trade Center Building 7 was the third of the three skyscrapers that collapsed on September 11th. It was later in the afternoon and just fell like a classic controlled demolition from the bottom up. It fell and it kinked in the top. It was a 47-story building. And so a lot of people still don't even know about that building existing and haven't fallen on that day. But the tenants were very interesting, as I mentioned to a previous caller. And also, relative to this paper, the active thermitic material, there were pools of metal, molten metal, underneath World Trade Center 7 and also underneath World Trade Center 6, which was the customs building across the street from World Trade Center 7, which is very interesting to me, the pattern of damage to that building. It was called the donut because the exterior walls of the building were all intact, and there was this huge crater in the middle of the building as if a bomb had gone off in that building as well. So World Trade Center 7 is definitely very interesting. It's a lot of people have talked about it, mentioning the mainstream sources that had predicted its collapse before it ever did. And that is really incredible considering the final story that the government investigators put out. Nobody could possibly have predicted this very obscure sequence of events that NIST has claimed brought down this building. So for BBC, for example, to predict that the building fell 25 minutes before it did, CNN also predicted it. It was very strange to hear about those things.
And you have a paper on this particular topic on journalof911studies.com, is that correct?
Yeah, we have several papers on World Trade Center 7, and including one, again, on the testimonies from the firefighters, 60 firefighters who were told that this building was coming down and heard explosions and so forth.
We've got about a few minutes left, and I want to get another call in here. But I just want to remind listeners that the it's going to take a lot of work on your part to actually do the research. You're going to have to spend some time. You're going to have to read, and there's no simple answers here. But what we are focusing on is the scientific data and the recent paper that we've been discussing. Is groundbreaking, and the first half of the show, if you missed it, we'll find it in the archives, but we spent a lot of time on the details. Active thermitic material discovered in dust from the 9/11 World Trade Center catastrophe, and I'm on the air with Kevin Ryan. We've got a few minutes left. We're going to go to one more call, maybe two if we get it in fast. So be brief if you can. Ron in Los Angeles, welcome to the show.
Kevin, I just finished reading the paper myself at lunchtime, and I wanted in particular to ask, in 2001, how available was this nanothermitic material, and where was it available outside of closely secret guarded government military bases? I'll take the answer off there. Thank you.
Thank you for your question.
Okay, yeah, the paper goes into a little bit of the availability of the technology prior to September 11th, and I don't know that they're secretive guarded laboratories, but I guess they are somewhat secure. National laboratories around the country were preparing these materials, and it was quite prevalent, the research throughout all the military branches as well. So, as I said, back to the mid-90s, people were investigating these, and there's a lot of interest in nanothermites, and it's not just for bringing down buildings, of course, but there are a lot of different applications for these materials, and they've been out there being investigated and being produced for quite some time.
Well, I wish we had more time. We've only got about a minute left, and Kevin, I want to give you some an opportunity to have some final thoughts on the matter and perhaps give some URLs out, any other information that people should follow up with.
Well, this paper is really groundbreaking, as you said. It really follows up on a couple of other peer-reviewed papers that we've had published, and it leads into additional work. So, for example, I've prepared a few of these nanothermite formulations myself, and am looking at how they react, how they ignite, how those ignition residues look compared to World Trade Center dust particles. I'm also doing other techniques myself, as are the other scientists who co-authored the paper with me. We're looking at FTIR. We're looking at what's called Mossbauer spectroscopy, and potentially LCMS and other techniques, because we'd also like to test for residues of more typical explosives. We'd like to look for RDX, for example. So all that kind of work is coming up, and new papers will be published. We really appreciate the opportunity to speak about it. One last thing I always like to throw in an interview is that the 9/11 first responders need help, and you can go, if you'd like, to another URL, to the Feel Good Foundation, F-E-A-L-G-O-O-D, foundation.com, where you can help the 9/11 first responders who showed up to rescue people, clean up the event. These aren't necessarily 9/11 truth activists, but they do need help.
Kevin, thank you very much for joining us today on the show. Really appreciate it. It was great to have you back.
Thank you, Chris.
All right, take care. You've been listening to KPFK 90.7 FM, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, worldwide at kpfk.org. Thanks to my engineer, D'Angelo Jones, Christine Blasdale for her assistance today. Stay tuned for Voices from the Frontline. If you missed any of today's program, you can log on to kpfk.org and click the archives. All right, thanks again for listening. We'll be back next week. This is Indie Media On Air. I'm Chris Burnett. We're out.
Come on. Start, baby. Oh, I'm so late. Please don't do this to me. Yes! Come on, come on, come on, come on! Yes, yes, yes! Come on! Oh! God, son of a piece of... I give up.
If that old junker in your driveway is a lost cause, you can always donate it to KPFK through our auto donation program. It's as simple as calling 877-KPFK-AUTO and asking the operator to assist you in arranging for a pickup. We'll tow it away and we'll mail you all the necessary paperwork for you to write it off of your taxes. Call us now at 877-KPFK-AUTO or donate online at kpfk.org by clicking Pledge Support.
On Sunday, April 12th, the life and legacy of Mexican revolutionary Emiliano Zapata will be celebrated with the 15th annual March for Zapata. Marchers will be demanding full legalization, just immigration reform, and a stop to the ICE raids while remembering Atenco. The march will start at 9 a.m. at Roosevelt High School in Boyle Heights at the corner of Matthews and 6th Street and conclude at El Parque Mexico, a.k.a. Lincoln Park, located at the corner of Mission Road and Valley Boulevard. From 9 to 7, there will be traditional dances from Mexico and Guatemala. Music will include performances by Rosa Marta, Zárate, Xochitl Soneros, Cihuatse, Zapoteca Roots, Son Real, y Los Poetas del Norte. More information about the 15th annual March for Zapata on Sunday, April 12th is available at kpfk.org or by calling 323-854-2060. That's 323-854-2060. KPFK is a proud media sponsor.
The programming you're about to listen to on KPFK is made possible by listener sponsors like you. Thank you.
Welcome to Voices from the Frontline segment of 4 o'clock Public Affairs Hour on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and on the web at kpfk.org. My name is Damon Azali Rojas. Today we have a very special treat, a little change of pace from our normal show. We're joined in studio for an hour by two exceptional musicians performing in Los Angeles this past week. Omar Sosa and John Santos are not only accomplished and recognized composers and performers in Afro-Caribbean music and Latin jazz, they are true students of their craft, deeply knowledgeable in history, cultural, and spiritual elements of the music that they make. We're going to talk with Omar and John about their lives and careers and how spirituality and